Okay, we're starting Daniel today. It's our first class. Certainly, in order to do justice to Daniel, one has to have very much an introduction from what is happening in the world at that time outside of Israel. And we'll start, to be sure, with an introduction of what's happening in the Bible outside of Daniel. Daniel tells of future events of the Jewish people for the Second Commonwealth, the Second Temple period, and, according to many commentaries, events that have not even yet taken place. He gives prophecies deep, deep into the future, and he certainly, in addition to this, of course, has a contemporary message for the Jews who, at the time of his writing, were living under the yoke of Babylonia and then under the yoke of Persia. He speaks to the people during the 70-year exile period that Yirmiyahu spoke about. And the purpose of this book and other books like Zechariah or Yechezkel is to assure that when the Jews do return after 70 years, they are perfectly capable of starting anew, not making the same mistakes as the old. In fact, Zechariah sets that up very well. The very beginning of Zechariah starts off, God was very angry with your parents, and there is no reason for you to think that you must repeat their mistakes. In the ancient world, they were very fatalistic. They were deterministic. They believed that your fate was determined for you, and there was no changing it. These prophets had to tell them, just because your parents made mistakes does not mean that you must repeat them or suffer for them. Yirmiyahu in Eicha actually says, Avoseinu chatonu ve'enenu va'anachnu ba'avonoseihem savonu. Our parents sinned and do not exist any longer, and we continue to suffer for their indiscretions. Zechariah and Daniel and the like are begging us to believe in a better day that does not necessarily have to repeat these mistakes of the old. Part of the mission is to be sure that the Jews do return after these 70 years are over. Right? We have to, in order for this Second Commonwealth to be a success, we want to make sure that the thousands upon thousands of Jews who were taken out of Israel, not only in the exile of Babylonia, but even from the exile of Assyria, that they feel an impetus to return. Yirmiyahu in chapter 3 speaks of the return of the 10 tribes. Even though really God shouldn't take them back, but because he's a chassid, lo etzor lo olam ki chassid ani, I will take you back and you will come back. Right? There's a dispute in Maseches Gittin over whether, in the Rishonim, whether there was Yovel and Bais Sheni or not. And it's dependent on this issue, because Yovel needs the representation of all 12 tribes living in Israel. Right? So there is an opinion that all 12 tribes did return. There is even a Rashi in Sefer Ezra. It says, Kol ha-kol ke-echad, Rashi writes, every tribe was represented. Somehow subsequent to that, they lost their identity. They just all became melded into one tribe and called themselves Jews, Yehudim. Right? So there was, however, a pitiful showing of only 42,360 Jews that came back. What can account for the great promise that Haggai spoke about, if you return and build me this temple, that Yirmiyahu spoke about in chapter 31, after the first day, the second day of Rosh Hashanah, v'shavu banim l'gvulam, and there will be such great promise in the land. Or that even Yeshayahu speaks about, long in advance, at the end of his book about returning from Bavel. What went wrong? What happened to this promise? So remember, we've spoken about... We've spoken about this, I remember, on Tisha B'Av recently, that there were two things working against the Jews that made it very difficult to assure a good turnout for the return to Israel after 70 years. Two very, very difficult points. One was that the community in Israel had been non-existent all those 70 years. When Yirmiyahu predicted the fall of the nation, he begged them to make peace with the Babylonians and they'll allow you to stay. They won't destroy your temple. They won't destroy your houses. They won't even kill your king. They'll just put you to tribute. They may even make you slaves, but at least you'll be able to remain. They're not interested in exiling you. Just give in to them. Lay down your arms. It was not a popular message, not much more popular than Israel giving in to Iran today, which I'm sure you know the Neturei Karta would like us to do. Yirmiyahu was simply not giving a popular message. Remember the film we saw on Yirmiyahu that was not popular at all, right? So that is the fact that they fought made the Babylonians carry many of them off into exile, and even then they still had a chance because they the Babylonians said, "Don't do anything to Yirmiyahu. Don't do anything to Yirmiyahu. He wanted to make peace with us, so don't harm him in any way." And Yirmiyahu was allowed to, with a small community, remain in Israel so that he could till the soil and work the vineyards and work the land all those 70 years while everyone else is in exile. So that when it comes time to return, we're talking about a hospitable land that's already working. Just buy up areas and come back and live. But when they killed Gedaliah and sort of ruined it, right? Even still a community remained that could have kept Israel working all those years. But then what did they do? They took Yirmiyahu down to Egypt and that was it. No more Jews remained in Israel. So then when it came time to return in 7 years, Israel was in such a bad state. If you don't work land for 70 years, you're taking shovel to rock. It's impossible to work such a land. Right? So that was the first thing working against them. Can you consider, ironically, what was the second thing working against them? Ironically, what's the second thing working against them? You'll see some of it in Daniel, but especially in Megillat Esther. They were doing so well in Babylonia and Persia. A sign of how well they were doing is Nebuch. A sign of how well they're doing, they did in America. They intermarried profoundly.
Kuthians
work
the land.
So there were people from Kuta who were brought in, and they did work the land up in the north to some extent, right? But it still wasn't enough to make it so hospitable for people to return. But yes, they were brought in by the Assyrians from before, and it's mashma that the Babylonians exiled a lot of them as well. Right. So that is the two things working against us. But Daniel's job, just like, is sort of hidden. Just like the story of Esther is a bit hidden. It'll come up over the year. But as I've said a number of occasions, the story, especially of the first chapter of Esther, gives interesting interpretation to when the Gemara says, where do we see a reference to Esther in the Torah? So it says, I will hide my face. And I will hide my face from you. So the traditional interpretation of that is that God's name does not appear in Megillat Esther. His name is hidden. I will hide myself. However, we can have perhaps a deeper interpretation that says that the true message of what Megillat Esther is about is hidden. Because the story isn't just about a Jewish community in Persia that came to danger and then was saved. The story is how the Jewish community came to consider their Persian roots more important than their Israelite roots, and their roots in Israel. You see, the words used in the beginning of the story to describe the festival of Ahasuerus, right? Words that only appear in Tanakh with respect to the Mishkan or the Beis HaMikdash, words like Tiferes, Techeles, Butzvargamon, things are colors that you only see describing the workings of the Mishkan or the Beis HaMikdash, and it seems that Ahasuerus' palace has taken the place of the Chatzir of Ahasuerus has become the Chatzir of the Mishkan. Only two cities are called Bira in the whole Tanakh, Shushan HaBira and Yerushalayim HaBira. For the Jews, it became Kimi Shushan Tetzei Torah, right? Udvar Hashem may Shushan HaBira. So, you know, it's a sort of a parody, and especially even when he's drinking from the kelim shonim, we read it like echatrop, because we have a tradition that he was feeding. It's a party goers were eating from the kelim of the Beis HaMikdash, which is an amazing irony. They say the Gemara says that the party lasted 180 days. That's what's written, and he showed six different types of kavod, tiferes, malchut, right, to five different types of people. So 5 times 6 times 180 is 5,400. Exactly the amount of kalim that were in the Beis Hamikdash. Exactly the amount of kalim that's found in Ezra Perek Aleph that were taken from the Beis Hamikdash. So what's happening is, and the Hashverosh, who the Gemara says through this party in his third year, because that was according to his Cheshbon, the 70th year for the Jews who were not returning. So he was celebrating the fact that the Jews were not returning. And when the Gemara asks, Amar Shalu Tamir of Rav Shimba Yochai, Mipnei Ma, why did the Jews deserve destruction in that generation? Why? Remember what the Gemara says? Al Shenehenu. Not just that they felt they had to go because they were in trouble if they didn't show up, but they enjoyed it. The whole point of that Suda was to celebrate the demise of the Jew. And the Jew is enjoying, the secular Jew is enjoying it. Right? So that is So that's really what's happening now between Daniel, between Esther, is that the community of Israel is suffering. And the community of Jews living outside of Israel are doing pretty well. And that's a problem that has faced us and our redemptive aspirations for a long, long time. And that is where we begin in Daniel. Okay. There's certainly much more to do, and we're going to have to also see some of Ezra and Nehemiah, and for sure to be familiar with the basic message of Haggai and Zechariah. Maybe I'll spend another few moments now just elaborating a little bit on that. Haggai has a singular message. His message is, you need to come back and help build the Beis HaMikdash. That's it. No morality, no claims against immorality, just that the people, if the immorality of the people is that they're not extending themselves to build the Beis HaMikdash. Simple as that. Right? Zechariah does speak about morality and pursuit of truth and pursuit of peace, and he does speak about righteousness and business practices and how you deal with your money and how you take care of the poor. That definitely appears in Zechariah. His message is that you need to fix those things so that this second commonwealth is a blessing and that it can succeed. But Zechariah has, and we'll see from the latter part of Daniel, a much more all-encompassing message. And here is what I submit to you. And it's based on the parish of Abarbanel and based on Chazal and things you cannot avoid seeing in the book itself. The last chapter of Zechariah is, you may recall, the Haftorah we just read 2 weeks ago, a story of the invitation of the Jews for the nations of the world to join us in the Sukkah. And they better join us, because if they don't join us, they'd be in trouble. They won't get the rain that comes this time of year. All this is, of course, very much metaphorical. There seems to be a battle going on, and when there's war, you don't have to sit in the sukkah. You don't have to bomb shelter. But the point is that Zechariah, the basic point is that Zechariah invites the nations of the world to join us in the sukkah. That's why, if you recall the Gemara in Maseches Avodah Zarah, where the Goyim ask for a mitzvah, God gives them the mitzvah of sukkah because of this pasuk. This is a very basic point. Ravanel uses this basic point of chapter 14 to outline the very cryptic messages, 13 messages that Zechariah gives in his first six chapters. They're all visions in the night. And each one has an historical message that Zechariah claims, that according to Ravanel, is meant to prepare this new community for the Second Temple period. Sometimes Zechariah himself doesn't really understand what he's seeing or saying. He says so. Right? This is what makes Rashi write in his introduction to Zechariah, this is the most difficult book of the Bible. Right? So what these visions have in common is that they are a grand opportunity for the Jewish people. It's a grand opportunity for the Jewish people to make the rest of the world see the beautiful grand nature of monotheistic ideal. It was not going to succeed the first time you came into Israel under with Yehoshua and the Shoftim and the kings. It wasn't going to succeed in Adarabba. The Gentiles in your midst were more likely to rub off on their way upon you than you to rub your Torah away upon them, because they were very Philistine in nature, you get what I'm saying? They were dealing with Ammonites, Moabites, Edomites, and Philistines, and Canaanites, and Sidonites. They were not ready to listen to your Torah way of life. But now, I am going to spread my word out that can might be heard if you do it right. They will love wisdom. They will be philosophers. It's a new world out there. You need my Ishas Haaretz, already said Haggai. And Zechariah's first vision is of three horses running in front, in back of one horse leading them. And the last vision, again, is three horses led by one horse. And the Barbanel, amazingly, I mean, you have to see this inside. What I'm about to tell you is going to make you fall off your chair. He says the first one is Alexander the Great, led by three kingdoms. The last one is Columbus, leading three ships to the New World. He says that there is a chance to spread the monotheistic word to the whole world. And if you do it right, it will spread. Now, Nebuch, we didn't do it so right. But, you know, there are, what, how many million of us? 12 million? There are about 100 times that amount of Christians and Muslims who have spread a monotheistic ideal based on us. There's no question about that. So the Rambam says that ideal has been spread by us. Just not according to the best possible way that the Rambam says could have been. But he does say that this is the opportunity that is presenting itself, and don't lose the opportunity. So that is what Zechariah is about. All 13 of his visions point in that direction, according to Barbanel. I must tell you that there are other commentaries who don't have such a position. Other commentaries say all 13 visions are contemporary messages. I'd have to go along with the Barbanel on some of the visions. One of the visions is about a never-ending supply of oil for a menorah with many tubes in it, about a struggle against assimilation, and a battle that is won by few against the many. You can tell me that that's not a prediction about Hanukkah? When Zechariah saw that vision, he claimed, I don't know what this is about. Of course he didn't. The Hanukkah story hadn't happened yet. So Barbanel says, the best reader of Zechariah, and for sure, I think even more so, and of Daniel, because the latter half of Daniel, after you get to the interesting part that everybody knows, the lion's den and the fiery furnace, the latter part of Daniel can only be understood by the historian in light of what we know to be historical. So that's the question. Are we going to build our ideas into the text? We might. We'll see what the Mefarshim do. Right? Daniel is going to refer to many very, very cryptic things which someone with a vast knowledge of the history of the Persian empires and then the Greeks and Romans will try to fit it into what ultimately happened. Okay? So we're going to have to be historians in this realm. Okay, there are two excellent books written from a Masoreti standpoint. Is the Das Sofrim. Have you heard of Rabinowitz? Das Sofrim is an excellent work on this. And also there's a book called Am Olam by Rotenberg. Have you heard of it? It's been translated. Am Olam. And it's very good. It gives a very, very, very interesting historical framework of these books. Okay, so let's take our attentions now to the text, please. All right, Bishnas Shalosh L'Malchus Yehoyakim Melech Yehuda. Bo Nebuchadnezzar Melech Bavel Yerushalayim Vayatzar Olam. In the third year of Yehoyakim, the king of Yehuda. That would be the year 606. Okay. Nebuchadnezzar came to Yerushalayim and besieged it. Okay. This is described in Sefer Malachim. Right?
No, I have.
Now, listen to what happened at that time. is that Yirmiyahu predicted that the Babylonians will continue to wreak havoc upon us, and we'd better lay down our arms. Could Yirmiyahu imagine that Tzidkiyahu, Yehoyakim's, here's the line, is Yoshiyahu, right? After him ruled his son, Yehoahaz, right? After Yehoahaz ruled his brother, Yehoyakim. After Yehoyakim ruled Yehoyakim's son, Yehoyachin. And after Yehoyachin ruled Yehoyakim's uncle, Yehoyakim's brother, Tzidkiyahu. So, Yoshiyahu had three sons who ruled on the throne. Who would have thought that Tzidkiyahu would be such a rat, such a misery, that he would make a deal with the Babylonians and hand over his nephew, Yehoyachin, a tender boy of 18, before he had a chance to have any children of his own, and hand him over to the Babylonians to be taken to be in captivity for 37 years, so that the Babylonians would appoint himself as king? That basically pushed off the Chorban 11 years. So that when Yirmiyahu's predictions of gloom and the upcoming doom of the Babylonians didn't happen, it posed him as a liar. Yirmiyahu has been saying the Babylonians are going to destroy us. It's not happening. See? The king made a deal. Right? Mm. Right? Because Yirmiyahu probably could. That Hashem doesn't tell every Navi everything. Only Moshe has the ability to sort of have a direct line whenever he wants. So Yirmiyahu, not every prophet knows everything at every time. Yirmiyahu didn't figure that this prediction that I saw of the Babylonian destruction would be forestalled because of such a treachery. Right? So in the third year of Yehoyakim, right, which is a full 8 years before this happens. Yehoyakim ruled 11 years. And besieged it. Okay. Vayitain Hashem biyado es Yehoyakim melech Yehuda, u'miktas klei beis elokim v'yayim eretz shinor beis elohav, v'sakelim hevi beis otzer elohav. God allowed Nebuchadnezzar, the religious, the frumkeit in the expression, everything is God doing. Right? Even the bad. God allowed this to happen, and he took some of the kelim of the Beis HaMikdash. This makes good sense with Yirmiyahu chapter 28, when there was a prediction that made by Hananiah ben Azur, the Rasha, who said that, don't worry, the kelim will be brought back. We're going to get him back just in a few years. In fact, in just 2 years. Yirmiyahu said, Bavel yuvov shama yuyu ad yom pakti osam. They're staying there for a long, long time before I bring it back. Right? So not only did after his reign, the Babylonians took all the remnant of the Kalim back. Right? So the first they took a few. Means that they had their, what does it mean to take some of the Kalim of the Beis HaMikdash? They just walked right in and took what they wanted. And said, you should try to stop us from taking what we want. And they left back behind some stuff. Vayemar HaMelech LaAshpenaz Rav Sarisav LaHavim Mibnei Yisrael LeMizera HaMlucha Minat Partimim. So he told Ashpenaz, it's a nice Babylonian name, the head of his Sarisim. Now, the word is quite common in the Bible. It's directly translated as eunuchs, and the Babylonians did keep eunuchs. The problem is that the word appears by the Egyptians also, they did keep eunuchs, but it appears in Jewish kings too. So the word saris does not necessarily always mean that. It's very, very, very prohibited by the Torah to do such a thing. But it could mean just an official. Right? So Nebuchadnezzar liked to be surrounded by wisdom. They loved wisdom. This might explain why Nebuchadnezzar's daughter or granddaughter, Vashti, was so despised the ways of her husband, Ahasuerus. All right, you're the queen, he's in charge, so you bite your tongue most of the time. But the Persians were very boorish compared to the the wisdom-loving Babylonians. The Babylonians were very scientific, right? They had libraries. And the Persians, at least at this time, you see that they're just spending their time drinking and partying all together, right? So Vashti looks with contempt upon her husband and his ways. That's why when he calls her in to show off her beauty, it says, Lahavi es Vashti Hamalga, to show off her beauty. Next pasuk, Batema'ein Hamalga Vashti. It switches. And he says, bring in Vashti, who's queen because she's my wife. And she says, what are you talking about, you boor? Batema'ein Malka Hamalka Vashti. I was a princess well before I met you, you stable driver, you know. Anyway, the Babylonians loved to be surrounded by wisdom, and the word was out that the wisest are amongst the Jews. So bring me some of those Jews. And that explains why in Sefer Yirmiyahu and Sefer Malachim, when they did exile the Jews in 597, 8 years from the beginning of this book, they took all of the wise ones, all the craftsmen, all the experts and the specialists, and they brought them back. Because he liked to be surrounded by wise people. Any moment he had something to say, he said, oh, quick, get me my, it was a Google right next to him. All the people, anything he wanted to know, they had to have right in front of them. Yiladim asher ein bahem kol mum. Yiladim means young ones. Have no blemish. V'tovei mare u'maskilim b'chol chochma b'yodei da'as u'mabinei mada. V'asher koch bahem lamod b'heichal ha'melech u'lelamdom sefer u'lishon kastim. They have to be good looking. No blemish. They have to have seichel with every chochma. You see a lot of different levels of cognitive thinking in this pasuk. Right? Knowledge is the lowest level of cognitive thinking. Then you use your knowledge to comprehend. Then you use your comprehension to synthesize information. Right? Based on this information, how can that affect that information? And then make an analysis and draw conclusions based on all of that. And I say, look, I'm a scientist. Right? That involves seichel, chochma, bina, das. These are all not just synonyms in Hebrew. There's all different levels of cognitive thinking. Studies show that teachers in high school and even in college are asking questions on tests that don't challenge the student past simple knowledge and sometimes comprehension. Right? Okay, the best kind of question is to even, you can, and studies also show, is that kids at 8 and 9 years old can be trained to think on higher cognitive levels. Right? Based on the way that Abraham speaks to God here, what did Yitzchak learn to speak differently there? In order to change something with respect to his wife, that Avram didn't do something like that. Okay, so notice the word Mada appears here. Mavine Mada. Have you ever heard that word before in the Bible? I'm reading Pasuk Dalet. Mada is the Targum Onkelos to the word Das whenever it appears in the Torah. So the tree of knowledge is a tree of Mada. Okay, it's an Aramaic word. All right, this is Babel. They speak Aramaic. Don't be surprised that the word Mada appears here. The word Mada only appears one other place in the Bible. It appears in Divrei Hayamim, describing Shlomo HaMelech's wisdom. It says he was a man of great Mada. There you go.
That means secular knowledge?
Well, and you know, YU has a theme called Torah Mada.
That's what I'm thinking.
I remember hearing once in Torah. Torah Madas, there was someone who gave a speech against it. Torah Mada is a toeva. It's an abomination. Everything is Torah. It's Torah U. It's Torah. So what's Torah Madas? Das is just the Hebrew word for Mada. So Torah Madas is okay.
Because they're using the Hebrew word, not the Aramaic word.
Okay, Oraisa Umada, we should call it. Okay. All right, so...
Is Mum spelled anywhere else?
No. We can look that up, but it could be the word Mum is defective because the Babylonians had their pursuit of what perfection was defective. So I was going to make a drash out of it. Okay. But they also have to, in addition to all of that, because people who are very wise tend not to be so strong. They're not out in the fields gaining strength and exercising. They're busy exercising in their seat, they're exercising their brains. But they, so they have to be not only well endowed in their wisdom, they have to be able to stand before the king for very extended periods of time. What a pompous schlubby is.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Could you take woman with an aleph to be sure to rule that there was nothing?
No, it could be, it's interesting. Nothing wrong. Mi'uma means usually nothing wrong. But okay. All right. So they had to learn. They had to be well versed in classics, Sefer they're talking about, and Lashon Kastim, of course, speak their language.
But what is the language of Kastim?
In Aramaic. So how come in chapter 5 they couldn't read Mene Mene Tekel Farsin? It's a perfectly good Aramaic word. And I'm talking about the handwriting on the wall. How were they not able to read that? Right? So the Gemara just says because it was either written in code or it was written with different characters. If I write good morning with Hebrew letters, and someone who speaks English can't read that. Right? Pashut mode. But once he read what it said, they all understood it. Okay? All right, so the king liked to have these kind of people surrounding him at all times. And there's worse things than this, but Nebuch, when this happens and he wants to get the best people to surround him, Jews will be overrepresented. And I say Nebuch because that causes jealousy. Remember when I think it was the 100th anniversary of the Statue of Liberty, they wanted to honor people of great accomplishment in the United States over the last 100 years who came from every nation represented by those who crossed through Ellis Island, about 120 countries. What did they find out? 75 of them were Jews. So they had to change. They had to change it. They didn't. They said no. They looked at Jews not as an Albanian Jew, Hungarian Jew, Romanian Jew,
just
or
as Jews.
Polish Jew. They said too many Jews. And then I think they even changed the nature of the program because of that. So I've heard explanations of why we tend to do this. So of course, observance of Torah. Basically, certainly over time, it's basically true to your family, monogamous in general. Torah guarantees success, hashkafically, because Hashem makes it so. But just the way of the Torah is a way of success, right? And Ruchei Dechinom, so it's going to work, right? So, but also, just an interesting scientific point is that the way the reading of Hebrew goes, where you have to do two things at the same time, from 4 years old, 3 years old, when you first start to read Torah, Tziva, Lanu, Moshe. Right, for a good Hebrew reader, we don't even need the dots, but have to do both of those at the same time, because the same four letters can be Torah, Torah, Tori, Toru, and then you have to work that through. It's much harder than just reading E-L-E-V-E-N, which could mean, eples, apples, opals, oople's. It's the same letter. It could be all those different things. But in English, no. It's apples with an A. It would be eples with an E, opals with an O. But in Hebrew, you have to process so much more already at 2, 3, 4 years old when you start to read in your little chaveri, so that makes you work both sides of the brain with great, great exercise at the very outset. Okay, you with me? Piano playing also does that very well, too. Because you're exercising. You're practicing two different things at the same time. Okay. V'yaman lohem ha-melech dvar yom b'yomo mipat bag ha-melech. Now, we're reading Hebrew now. But this book is filled with Aramaic words, and patbag is certainly not a Hebrew word. Although I will tell you this, Sadigo goes to great lengths to show that he felt that Hebrew was such a superior language. I understand why, because the Muslims were writing great poetry at that time, and they were claiming that Arabic is a much more beautiful language than Hebrew, and its grammar is much, much superior. So Sadigo went to the other side and tried to show that, no, I'd rather, our language is superior in. Well, what's older, Ivri or Arav? So they're both very old. I mean, Ivri isn't from Avraham. Avraham is, Ivri is from a man named Aver. Shane Vaver, you've heard of them, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right. So, whether there could be there was a Hebrew language before that, Ibn Ezra claims there was. Ibn Ezra says Elad Menachah spoke Hebrew. Because if he says, I'm naming you Isha Kimei Ishlu Kacha, it couldn't be Aramaic. You wouldn't say, I'm calling you Itasa Kimei Migavra. They're two mm-hmm. different words. So the word for man and woman have to be similar. Anyway, it says here that he Vayman, he set up for them a daily menu, mi patbag hamelech. So the word pat does mean bread. So mm-hmm. patbag can be some kind of
bread.
Bread sometimes means food in general. Umiyein mishtav ulegadlam shonim shalosh. He gave them the finest wines and the finest foods, and he would prepare them for 3 years. Umiktsa sum, only a few of them. Yamdu lifnei hamelech. Sounds a little like a Achashverosh, right? Sure, just spent to prepare these women for a few months. 3 years to prepare just to be able to stand before the king. Huh. This must have been fierce competition. Like model school or something.
Namely, the right social graces, the way to bow before the king.
Correct, absolutely. Everything you need to know about standing before the king, because these pompous windbags will banish you for winking in the wrong direction. Okay.
Another question on the previous pasuk. What's the relationship between the Persians and Kaskin?
Persians are not in town yet. They're not powerful yet at this time, at this point. Kasdim are used interchangeably with Bavlim. It's where Avram is from. It's the place where the Bavlim inhabit. Is it a separate people? It's so often used interchangeably. Right? When the Babylonians come, the people accused Yirmiyahu. You brought the Kasdim upon us. So, or Kasdim. It would be about Iraq today. And the Persians aren't in town yet. The Persians are coming in chapter 5.
What's in Yeshaya when he refers a lot to a place? I think it's like Ethiopia.
Yirmiyahu refers to a place called Lev Kamoi, which the Mephoshim say, we never heard of a place like this before. And then Rashi points out, Lev Kamoi is Atbash of Kastim. He didn't want the Kastim to know he was referring to that, so he coded it. He coded it with Atbash. He switched the letters. It's a type of code. Okay, so only a few, the chosen few, would get a chance to stand before the king. V'ibahem ibnei Yehuda, Daniel, Hananya, Mishael, V'Azaria. And 4 came from amongst the Jews. And these are their names. V'yasem lahem sara sarisim shemos. You can't stand before the king with a name like Hananya. First of all, he can't pronounce it. V'yasem l'daniel, that's not true. The Aramaic has a ch sound in it. Okay. V'yasem lahem sara sarisim shemos. V'yasem l'daniel bel teshatzar. Right? That Baal is the god of a Babylonian god. Hananya Shadrach, Mishael Meshach, Ulazaria Avednego. Okay. He gave them all names of Avodah Zarah, Rashi says. Okay. But Rashi only explains Belshazzar. Look, the next king after Nebuchadnezzar was named Belshazzar. That's very clear. Okay, so the Ibn Ezra points out something that he says in his Perush to the Torah. Try to think of people where their names are changed. Paro changes Yosef to Tzavchas Paneach. The Babylonians change Jehoiakim's name to another Babylonians. The Egyptians change his name to Eliakim. Mm-hmm. Babylonians changed Matanya to Tzidkiyahu. Right? It's a sign of I'm subjugating you to my will. I'm even changing your name. And you know what the Bechor Shor says? That's Avram and Yaakov. Yitzchak didn't need to be subjugated to God's will. He was such an Ola Tamima. Sarah also, Avram and Sarah. But change him. Not everyone agrees with this Cheshbon, I assure you.
So that's why they changed him, Avram and Sarah, to Avram and Sarah.
It's an expression of, I am changing you, but to be submissive to my
will.
Okay, so that's certainly what's happening here. But also because they don't have Babylonian names. Like you can't go to sit around the king's court with names like this. Right? Look, it may very well be that this book is only Daniel. It might be that if some other nationalities wrote books about some of their heroes who rose to lead, sit in the court, no one's reading them anymore, and it hasn't survived. Right? But maybe he changed everybody's name. Right? Okay? But it's more likely that the people who were put into this position changed the names themselves. I mean, it's a question whether, you know, I have a secular name. Of course, I also have a Hebrew name, but you see in the Gemara, there are names like Alexander, Yanai, there are names like
Alexander is a
Hyrcanus.
Alexander is a Hebrew name.
Right? It's true, but it starts off as a Greek name, right? But Hyrcanus, Maimon, Shragafival, those are both Greek names. Shraga is Aramaic, and Fival is Shraga in Greek. So is, you know, they've become, you know, very nice names today, but their origins are in other languages. All right, so it says that Vayosem Daniel pasuk ches Vayosem Daniel alibo asher lo yisko al bepat baga melech ubiyeh mishtav vayvakesh misara sarisim asher lo yisko al. And Daniel put to his heart. Not to, now look at the Lashon Yisga'al. Sometimes this is spelled with an aleph, sometimes with an ayin. Okay? Can you just give Ken a little shove? Ken? Just give him a kick. Ken, are you okay?
Yeah.
Just make sure. So. Yisgal means he would not defile himself with the food of the king and with his wine.
So wouldn't that be
the night? Yeah, it could be. But if it's words like that happens in Tanakh. Okay. So he would not defile himself with his food and with his wine. Ve'evakesh misara sarisim asher lo yisgal. And he begged this person. Now, does this sound familiar?
Yes.
Who else did this?
Yes.
Esther. Vayishaneha ve'esmanoseha. She changed the menu. She didn't want to eat the bacon and the pork that they were serving, and the ham and cheese and sandwiches that they were serving in the king's palace. Right? So that might have worked for Esther, but because, you know, I don't know, maybe at that time maybe a nice zaftik woman is what the king wanted. But they're looking for health here. How are you going to be able to stand before the king if you don't eat what we're giving you? Right? So I want to say a little about Nehemiah shortly also. We'll get to that in a minute. So it says, Vayitena Elokim es Daniel chesed ulerachamim b'fnei Sara sarisim. God made Daniel to have a good standing with him. The other three stood, you know, like they're subservient to Daniel. God made it so that these three would be in good, that Daniel would be in good standing, like it says by Esther. Right? So too, Daniel, got, you know, he knew how to, you know, squeeze their palms or whatever needed to be done so that he knew he would get in good stead. Vayomer Sarah sarisim Daniel. I'm afraid of the king. If he finds out that I changed your menu even one iota, why should you look less healthy than the other people your age, and then the king will kill me for that? Imagine what a fear this is. Right? So Daniel is Vayomer Daniel el Meltzer. I think Meltzer is still a modern word for waiter.
Waiter.
Yeah. So Daniel told the person who was in charge of the food, Hashem inos sarasar isim al Daniel hanani mishov azariah. Nasno es abadecha. Yomim asara. Test us for 10 days. V'itnu lana min ezeronim nochlo mayim v'nishte. Test us and see if eating vegetables and water will be better for us than eating meat and wine. Hello? What do we know today?
Yeah, definitely.
The Kliyakar says this. He says, look at the order of creation. First there's water, vegetables, fruit, fish, fowl, meat. Get it? Then I guess people are created afterwards. That would probably be the least healthy of all of them.
but
so that is, so he's saying, test us for 10 days and see if we by eating fruits and vegetables and water and nuts and grains, obviously grains also, will be better off than the people eating meat all the day.
Mm-hmm.
Putting all that cholesterol and fat in their arteries.
And getting drunk.
And getting drunk all the time. Yeah. So it's an amazing thing. Did he know something? But okay, be that as it may, he says, test us for 10 days. So I'm going to stop here, but I want to just conclude with Esther, who gets the same treatment, and Nehemiah. I have to tell you, I want to conclude today with Nehemiah. You know, Nehemiah is not its own book. You know, are you familiar with that?
Ezra Nehemiah.
I mean, there's a book that starts, Divrei Nehemiah. Open up, you'll see at the end of your Tanakh, you'll see a book called Nehemiah. Right? However, it's not its own book. There are 24 books in the Bible. Chamisha Chumshe Torah, Yeshua Shav Mishmo Malachim Yisheyo Yemiyah Yecheskel Treyaser, that's 13, right? Tila Mishla Eov, 16. Chamesh Megillos, 21. Daniel, 22. Ezra, 23. Divrei Hayamim, 24. Nehemiah is part of Ezra. Why doesn't he get his own book? If Nehemiah is a separate book, there are 25 books. Why doesn't Nehemiah get his own book? The Gemara asks this question at the end of Sanhedrin. And it says, because Nehemiah spoke against contemporaries of his. What did he say? In Sefer Nehemiah, he was in the same position. The king stood before the king, the Persian king, later than this. And he said, God, Zachra Elokai Li Latovah, remember me for good. I'm the only one who refused to eat the food of the king.
Well, that's not true.
Incidentally, he just says the food. He apparently did drink the wine of the king. You know what? Nehemiah has a nickname in the Tanakh. Remember his name? Nehemiah Hatirshata. He's called the Hatirshata. Heter Shtia. Come on, Darshans. Could have been just a family name, but Hatirshata. So the Gemara says that he had permission because he was actually the very wine pourer for the king. If you're pouring wine for the king, you have to drink it first. Always have to drink it first. So he had a heter to do that, and he helped the Jews. If not for Nehemiah, in fact, Ibn Ezra says Nehemiah was Zerubbabel. We'll get to that later. But Nehemiah plays a politically a more important role than Daniel, for sure. But Nehemiah keeps on calling attention to himself. Zachor li Elokai l'tova, that I didn't eat the bread and the food of the king like the other Jews. What are you talking about? Esther didn't. Daniel didn't. So he said that's why he doesn't get his own book. Because he while praising himself,
he managed
to mention that the other Jews ate the king's food. Maybe many of them did. Maybe the majority of them did. There were some Jews who managed to keep a good Jewish diet while being in the king's palace. Esther did. Daniel did. Right? So what we know today is that the diet that Daniel gave himself actually probably made him look healthier. Okay? Okay, so we're going to continue Mitzvah Hashem with Pasuk Yud Gimel. Perkal Pasuk Gimel. In previous years, we have learned a whole sefer. This is a much shorter sefer, so we're going to give much more attention. And that all means it's a harder sefer, so we'll make our way through. Yishkayach.